vaccinated. We also think the workers should be vaccinated. The university did not reach out to us to talk about this. We think it's important that I certainly think that all my members should be vaccinated. We want a safe campus. We all want a safe campus. Now, how they're going to mandate this and how it's going to work, honestly, there isn't enough transparency between us and the university, so it's hard to know. But from our vantage, faculty certainly skew older, and so we want a safe place if we're going to be in the classroom for our teachers. And so not only should the students be vaccinated, but we want our faculty to be vaccinated as well.
Well, I want to thank... Yes, go ahead, Christine. We have a few
seconds. Just to jump in, we strongly encourage our members to be vaccinated. We are not in support of a mandate for faculty and staff, but we are strongly in support of, we all want a health and safety, health and safe campus to return to, especially as we try to return to post-pandemic life.
Christine O'Connell, president of the Union of Rutgers Administrators, American Federation of Teachers, and Todd Wolfson, Rutgers Union of Grad Workers, Faculty, and Postdocs. Thanks so much for being with us. A happy birthday to Matt Ely. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a senior news producer to join our team here in New York City. Check it out at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
KBOO Portland.
Tune in to Cubby Cushy, Cubby Cush, Tuesday nights on KBOO. 2 hours of global bass with an emphasis on South Asia and the South Asian diaspora, and an even more special emphasis on the Punjabi diaspora. Hosted every Tuesday, 10 to midnight, by The Incredible Kid. This ain't world music, it's birth of a new world music.
Do you miss going to the theater? Looking for some drama? Then tune in for The Strange Case of Nick M., an all-new radio play by Imago Theater on Monday, May 3rd at 10 p.m. Listeners will be taken on Imago's trippy audio journey into a fragmentary world, narrated by a cocky podcaster who has unearthed a box of long-forgotten reel-to-reel tapes. So tune in on Monday, May 3rd at 10 p.m. and get ready for a very special premiere of Imago's The Strange Case of Nick M. right here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. One sector of society that is getting hard hit by COVID-19, but not getting much attention, is the U.S. prison population. Imprisoned people, along with frontline workers and communities of color, are extremely vulnerable to the deadly virus and are being severely impacted by it. The United States currently has the largest incarcerated population in the world, with about 2.3 million people in jails and prisons across the country, this according to the Prison Policy Initiative. More than half of them, nearly 1.3 million people in prisons, do not have the ability to socially distance or to take the sanitary measures needed to slow the spread of the virus. The effects of cramped and unsanitary cells have been disastrous across the country. An incarcerated person who is fighting for their life is Russell Maroon Schultz. Now, Russell Maroon Schultz is suffering from stage 4 cancer and COVID-19, but the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections will not release him. Today on Sojourner Truth, we bring you audio from a recent webinar entitled We Are Maroon, a teach-in for Russell Maroon Shows. The webinar, which was dedicated to showing solidarity with Russell, featured a wide range of speakers. They include Kempis Ghani, song star of the Amistad Law Project, Mike Africa Sr. of the MOVE organization, Dr. Gene Schneider, Robert Salim Holbrook of the Abolitionist Law Center, and Lavinia V, a human rights activist and counselor. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. The Minneapolis police chief who called George Floyd's death murder soon after it happened testified that Officer Derek Chauvin clearly violated department policy when he pinned Floyd's neck beneath his knee for more than 9 minutes. Chief Medario Arredondo took the stand on day six of Chauvin's murder and manslaughter trial. Arredondo says continuing to kneel on Floyd's neck once he was handcuffed behind his back and lying on his stomach was in no way, shape, or form part of department policy or training, and certainly not part of our ethics or our values.
And so while it is absolutely imperative that our officers go home at the end of their shift, we want to make sure and ensure that our community members go home too. And so sanctity of life is absolutely vital, that is the pillar for our use of force.
Arredondo's testimony came after the emergency room doctor who pronounced Floyd dead said he theorized at the time that Floyd's heart most likely stopped because of a lack of oxygen. Vice President Kamala Harris, a native of the East Bay, returned to Oakland for the first time since becoming vice president. She visited an East Bay Municipal Utilities District water facility to tout the $110 billion for clean water in President Biden's $2.3 trillion infrastructure plan. Prospects for passage got a big boost yesterday when the Senate parliamentarian ruled that aspects of it are filibuster-proof and only need 51 votes to pass. Mary Sherman filed this report.
It is great to be in Oakland and to be home.
Vice President Kamala Harris was back on her old turf of California Monday to promote the American Jobs Plan, which includes $111 billion for water infrastructure.
We must understand how precious this resource is. We must understand the equities and inequities of distribution and access to clean water, especially clean drinking water.
Republicans argue the $2 trillion plan is too broad. Others believe it's not enough. Massachusetts Democratic Senator Ed Markey called for Biden to go bigger.
Our country needs a roadmap for recovery that addresses the intersecting crises that we face as a nation and a planet. The climate crisis, a public health pandemic, racial injustice, and economic inequality.
The White House wants to fund the proposal through corporate tax code changes and other measures to discourage overseas investments. Democrat West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin said he'll support raising the corporate tax rate from 21% to 25%, not the 28% Biden proposes. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman.
Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen is urging the adoption of a minimum global corporate income tax. She said the aim would be to offset any disadvantage that might arise from the Biden administration's proposed increase in the U.S. corporate tax rate.
We're working with G20 nations to agree to a global minimum corporate tax rate that can stop the race to the bottom.
The Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy says 55 of the largest U.S. corporations paid no federal corporate income tax at all in 2020, despite enjoying substantial profits. Some even received federal tax rebates. President Biden is expected to announce today he's shaving about 2 weeks off his May 1st deadline for states to make all adults eligible for coronavirus vaccines. Biden reportedly plans to announce every adult will be eligible to be vaccinated by April 19th. The race is on to vaccinate millions more Americans as virus cases are surging once again and states relax mask and social gathering mandates. Also, new, more infectious variants are circulating widely. The Biden administration campaign to urge all people to get vaccinated as quickly as possible got support from Republican Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, speaking from his home state of Kentucky.
I saw on some program last week that Republican men, curiously enough, might be reluctant to take the vaccine. I'm a Republican man. I want to say to everyone, we need to take this vaccine.
A White House statement thanked McConnell for his leadership. The U.S. and Iran begin indirect talks to reinvigorate the nuclear deal President Trump withdrew the U.S. from. The European nations still in the deal will play a key role in brokering the talks they'll shuttle between the U.S. and Iranian delegations. State Department spokesman Ned Price warned the talks will be difficult.
We don't underestimate the scale of the challenges ahead. These are early days. We don't anticipate an early or immediate breakthrough, as these discussions we fully expect will be difficult. But we do believe that these discussions with our partners and in turn our partners with Iran is a healthy step forward.
Trump withdrew the U.S. from the international deal in 2018 and reimposed damaging economic sanctions. In response, Iran slowly began violating provisions of the deal. I'm Eileen Alfandari for Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and those were our news headlines. And now we kick off our Sojourner Truth special on Russell Maroon Schultz. During today's program, you will hear presentations by a diverse panel of campaigners and a webinar entitled We Are Maroon, a teach-in for Russell Maroon Schultz. They include Ghani Songster of the Amistad Law Project, Mike Africa Sr. of the MOVE Organization, Dr. Gene Schneider, Robert Salim Holbrook of the Abolitionist Law Center, and Lavinia V., a human rights activist and counselor. Let's hear from them now.
Hi, so I'm Sister Lavinia, a.k.a. V.
And I'm Kempis Ghani Songster. Welcome, everybody. We're very pleased and honored that you are joining us this evening for a virtual teaching for Russell Maroon Schultz, where we'll take a dive into the issues of COVID-19 behind the walls as it affects vulnerable elders and other vulnerable people, but specifically our political prisoners like Russell Maroon Schultz. Think about what you just heard. Think about what he's going through. It's really heart-wrenching, but we're here to lift up what we can do to affect change on his behalf and on behalf of those who are suffering egregious human rights abuses in this time of pandemic behind prison system.
Okay. And tonight we have to emphasize the importance and the urgency of the situation. Our brother Maroon has stage 4 cancer and COVID-19. So tonight we have people from all over, and we especially want to thank our participants for coming at short notice because they have the understanding that we need to get this information out here because we need Maroon released now. We're not asking them to take care of him anymore. He does not need to be there. We need him released now. So tonight we want to share with you some of the information that we have, some of the things that we can do, and some of the things that, you know, are actually being worked on right now. So we're going to start off and get into the health discussion first. And Brother Ghani is going to go and lead you into that about the diseases and illnesses that are lingering behind the walls.
Yes, thank you, thank you. And so we have with us tonight to talk about as we dive into this health segment, we're going to be having a conversation with Mike Africa Sr. Mike Africa Sr. is one of the original MOVE 9, one of the MOVE 9. Fortunately, Mike is now home with the rest of the living members of the Move 9. Mike and I personally did a lot of time together, and we would commiserate with each other as we struggled for better diet, cleaner water behind the walls. And what is important about this, the diet and the water piece, is how even the diet itself and the water contributed to, you know, people being immunocompromised behind the walls, you know, before COVID-19 even hit. Russell Maroon shows, as V mentioned, has stage 4 cancer. He survived prostate cancer. And a lot of times we don't even connect the role that prison diet plays and the water plays in the diseases that people catch behind the walls. Mike, remember, you know, at Greater Ford, the prison that that we left from the year 1991 till 2017, over 600 people had died in that prison. Mike, you know, I want to talk to you about the role that, you know, you think diet plays and water plays in the immunocompromised state that a lot of people find themselves in behind the prison walls.
Yeah, so that was heart-wrenching to listen to Maroon in his own words talk about his suffering. I'm out here right now with Chuck, who is in the same situation, who spent 42 years behind bars unjustly. And he's battling, you know, the same thing as the Delbert, who's succumbed to cancer shortly after he was released. Merle, 1998. Phil in 2015. Mumia fell ill. I fell ill. You know, and diet and water is directly linked. The ones who are surviving COVID now, they say how crucial it is for those people not to have any preconditions for them to survive. If you're in a state like Maroon is, you know, it's especially crucial that he gets the nourishment he needs to battle that disease. That they don't give it to him is just some cruel stuff, man. And, you know, they know it. Water, you know, if you're in a hospital, man, you know you have to get the best nutrition. You have to get the best diet. You have to get the best nourishment to battle anything you're facing, or it's going to be exacerbated by that lack of nourishment. You know, I myself became anemic in there trying to eat, and I was working in the kitchen, you know, and still became anemic because I wasn't getting the nutrition I need, you know. And it's just crucial, bro. It's crucial, and it is critical that he, you know, that everybody who can combine forces, man, to call or whatever they can do and get that brother home now, because it's apparent that they're not going to give him the diet that he needs.
So Mike, you know, again, like I was saying, you know, when we hear about these illnesses taking place behind the walls, and I'm not even getting to the COVID-19 piece yet. I'm talking about the cancers.
Right.
You know, it's not like people go into the prison with those diseases. They contract them while they're in prison. And we don't often hear enough about the role that the diet and the water plays in that. What would you know, tell us something about your experience and your struggles, you know, dealing with the food situation and the water situation behind the walls? Because we know that that's something that you didn't just accept. You know, you were fighting for better food and for cleaner water. And what were the results of some of those struggles?
Well, early on, when we were down Holmesburg prison and the sisters was down House Correction, we were on trial for murder.
When you say the sisters, Mike, you're talking about the women members of Move 9.
Right.
Right.
Right. At the time, it was the Move 9, plus it was other sisters there as well.
Oh, okay.
Other Move sisters there as well. and we were in the middle of a preliminary hearing with Judge Myrna Marshall, you know, with, you know, the diet, you know, you're going up to the seventh floor, they're trying to feed you these TV dinners, and, you know, and when you go back to Holmesburg, you know, they're giving you the various slop that they feed down there, and, you know, it was intolerable to us, man. You know, we knew how we ate on the street because of, you know, us being made aware of the importance of diet by, you know, Moose founder John Africa. So we ate a lot of raw food. We exercised as much as we could and ate as clean as we could because it cleaned our system. Anyway, so they was feeding us this slop, so we insisted that, you know, the officials deal with the situation of this tainted food. So much so that they gave us, stopped the hearing, the murder trial hearing, and gave us a hearing on diet, in which the officials came in, the Secretary of Prisons down there, the food manager down there, they all testified that it was impractical. But in the end, we got our diet. And not just something that they prepared, they went to the food co-op in our neighborhood and bought us crates of almost everything we asked for.
Like, for example? You know,
and garlic, boxes of garlic, grapes, onions, sweet potatoes, white potatoes, apples, pears, all kinds of fruits and vegetables, man. And I mean, I'm not talking about canned fruits and vegetables. I'm talking about fresh food. And so much so that we had our cell, not ourselves, a separate cell containing all the boxes of foods and fruits and vegetables that we won that case on. So, yeah.
Stop for a minute, Mike, because I think people need to understand this. We're talking about the jail system, the prison system, Holmesburg, where they were allowing people to bring food to y'all from the streets that was grown in gardens, community gardens, right? Co-ops, into the prison. And they were actually, they actually designated a cell for y'all to stock the food in.
Right.
And how many of y'all were able to make this happen?
It was 12 of us there. 12 moved people there, but of course we had support on the outside. I moved folks on the outside. So, you know, they were calling, you know, they were concerned. They were in the courtroom when the hearing was going on. They testified, you know, at the hearing about the importance of diet to us, you know, the importance of diet to everyone, you know, wasn't no small thing. So, and it wasn't that they allowed our folks to bring it up. They went and purchased it.
But then when y'all,
the food co-op on 35th and Race, and purchased all that food, and they have community gardens or a garden where they would group or grow some of the food. But it was all organic. It was all organic foods.
But after the case and y'all got up, after y'all were found guilty and sent upstate, that was done with. That was over. It was a new struggle.
One of our brothers, Frank Africa, who was one of the ones they murdered up at the Osage Avenue, Louise's son. He filed a suit because he ate nothing but raw. And so almost, you know, everything they were serving except the, you know, the little bit of fruit they served, is all he could eat, you know, all he would eat, and at the time. But he filed a suit trying to get his diet the same way we had down Holmesburg, down the county. But they struck it down. They didn't let him have it. So ever since that time, whenever we would then file another suit about it, they would use that case against us, even when they was giving almost everybody who asked for a diet their diet, under religious means or whatever, you know, but they kept on denying us, move people, any semblance of our, you know, a nutritional diet. And it wasn't until the diet that I was forced to eat that I became anemic in 2013-14 that they were forced to then give me a better diet.
I think, Mike, it's important to like, just to, for people, so people could understand the context of where you're coming from. Like, it's not just, you know, because people, a lot of people in society might have this idea, well, you went to prison, you know, you're not going in there to eat full course gourmet meals and stuff, you know, you're in a prison, you know what I'm saying? What do you expect? But it's not where you're just talking about, well, the food is not prepared well, or it's just sloppy. You're talking about the toxicity of the food. You're talking about the chemicals in the food. And you're talking about the toxicity of the water. This is what you're talking about, the unhealthiness of it.
Absolutely. The water was horrendous. Ghani, you was up Huntington too, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you probably recall that every time it rained up there, like the faucets would stick. You know, so that if you turn the water on, the water might be on for 3 or 4 hours until a plumber came, because it was so much sand and silt in that water system, because it was coming from a creek. And that creek was so contaminated on an ordinary basis, but after it rained, it was really saturated with a lot of filth. You know, so much so that it was stopping, you know, the water clogging the toilets and the spigots and stuff up there. Well, that's what we had to drink. Coming down Greater Ford, the staff won't drink that water at all.
I remember.
Right? So this water that they are afraid to drink, they are afraid to consume, that's all we're being served, and that's what they're cooking our foods.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So, you know, the great lengths we went to get other water. And it was, you know, so if you have any kind of weakness in your system, you know, like you said, immunocompromised, you know, that's, you know, it's going to exacerbate whatever you have in your system. And to fight off any illness, you need to be strong, man. You need your system not compromised, you know. And you see, we always ate that way ever since ever since anybody has seen us, you know, they see us being active, boxing, running, you know, racquetball, which, you know, we used to play, and, you know, we do the best we can in it, you know, but still, you know, 100% of the people, of our move people that was up Dallas, got cancer. 100% of them. And two of them has died, and as I said, Chuck is battling it, you know, in a battle for his life right now. You know, and Merle in 1998 of Muncie, and, you know, anyway.
Let me say this too, Mike. The water up Greater Ford where we were at, they found out that water was heavy with trichloroethylene,
Absolutely. Or
TCE, benzene, and chromium-6, all carcinogens, right?
Right.
And the water was so bad that it attracted the attention of a famous environmentalist, and environmental justice activist, and they came up there, and they did a big write-up on that in the Philadelphia Inquirer and the Montgomery County paper. Could you tell us about what came about after that and your experience with the EPA agents and stuff coming to yourself?
All right. So what happened was one of Maroon's great friends and comrades, Kareem Howard, I had a conversation with him about the water up there and, you know, our battle with trying to get water and once the water was allowed in the jail, water that we could afford, because they were charging us $20 a case or a 24-bottle case of water.
That cost like $3.99 out here, right?
Exactly. And that was 15 years ago that they were charging us $20 a case. You know, so they had these... Anyway, I had a conversation with Kareem. And Kareem put this information, the gist of this information on the out on the air. And it was about the war. And he was saying that, you know, our brothers and sisters have been up there since 1978. And they don't even have clean water to drink, man. They're not asking for this and that. And said, so, you know, they just asked for some clean water, you know. And it's a shame that they can't even get water. You know, something has to be done about this. At the time, he was on the air with PAM Africa, right? And, you know, they called, giving them hell about it. You know, they called some folks on the street and, you know, that grew. So my son was the one who called the office of Erin Brockovich. And she got involved. She had the water somehow tested and came with the conclusion that you just recounted a few seconds ago about what that water contained. While they were telling us, you know, what happened was, as a result of that radio spot that Kareem and Pam did, they sent EPA up to myself up in Greater Fort. So they came, you know, I didn't know they was coming. You know, they knock on the door one day and it's two EPA officials, two maintenance officials, and two guards, you know, and they come in and they test the water and shake, you know, put in a little vial and shake it up like, you know, they're doing some thorough tests. And they said the water was fine on the spot, you know. So the maintenance dudes left, and, you know, and then after that, my son called, you know, the office of Erin Brockovich, and she got involved. And she wrote that scathing report that was in anger.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're going to take a quick station break. When we return, we will continue our special on Russell Maroon Schultz. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Sojourner Truth. Check us out on our website at SoTrueRadio.org. If you're a member of Facebook, you can look for us and friend us there. Our handle on Instagram and Twitter at SoTrueRadio. We're also on SoundCloud. Just go to the search bar and type in Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott to find us. And today, we'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Washington, D.C. and internationally. We would like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Spain. Now, we return to our special on Russell Maroon Schultz. During the second half of today's program, you will hear more presentations by a diverse panel of campaigners and a webinar entitled We Are Maroon, a teach-in for Russell Maroon Schultz. They include Gani Songster of the Amistad Law Project, Mike Africa Sr. of the MOVE organization, Dr. Gene Schneider and Robert Salim Holbrook of the Abolitionist Law Center, and Lavinia V, a human rights campaigner and counselor. Let us hear from them now.
When we're talking about the incarcerated population, we're talking about a population of already immunocompromised people, just period, already, before even COVID-19. Whether you're over 65 or not, you're already immunocompromised from the diet, from the water, from the toxic land base that it's built on. Whether it's Greater Fort, Mahanoy, Fayette, it's the same thing. I see right. Salim nod. I know Salim know exactly what we're talking about. You know what I mean? And so when you're 65 or when you're 77 like Maroon, you know, it's even worse. You know, it's right. Even a more delicate and dire situation. And Mike, just one last piece. I remember when you used to smuggle tomatoes and cucumber and carrots and stuff out of the kitchen at risk of losing not just your little prison slave job, but being written up and thrown in the hole. Used to smuggle that stuff out to get to Maroon when he got released from the hole into population. Used to smuggle him fresh vegetables just to eat, right? And Maroon would tell me, go ahead, brother.
No, go ahead.
And Maroon would tell me, he said, man, tell Mike. He said, tell Mike, thank you so much. If I could eat like this every day, I wouldn't eat nothing else. Right? It made him feel so good. And then what did he tell you when he saw you?
He said basically what you said, you know, and how good it made him feel and how good it made his system feel, you know. And I'll tell you something, bro. It's like the little things I was getting, you know, wasn't a chore to, you know, the staff there. You know, they wouldn't mind you taking certain things out. You know, you weren't trying to steal 10 hamburgers and all that kind of stuff. You know, they didn't mind you taking it because that was the kind of stuff they were throwing away anyway. So it wasn't like they couldn't give it to the population. You know, so they didn't mind you having a few things. You know, but my point is that nourishment, the same way it made Maroon feel, you know, is the same way it could have had, you know, the population feel, you know, because they had enough of it to serve, you know. And one person I didn't mention falling to some of that same treatment is Mumia. You know, Mumia, you know, because of that diet also, and because he was battling Hep C, which he fought for and had everybody get, you know, the vaccine for that stuff, you know. As usual, you know, when he come up with something, he's the last to get it. You know, he's getting brothers off death row and they wouldn't take him off of there for another 25, 30 years, you know. But anyway, yeah, brother, I was honored to give Maroon those vitamins, that much needed protein, that much needed shot of something that he really needed, something that we all need, you know. And it's not a thing that it's a favor that you're doing us, you know. And people, for like you said, for the people who were saying, well, they up there in prison, what do they expect, you know? Well, we expect the same things you give your people when they're caught doing something. You know, you don't expect them to be tortured and starved to death nutritionally, you know. So we don't expect anyone to be treated that way. So you know, we was fighting for this. We have moved. We've been fighting for this long before we even went to prison ourselves and became victims of the same type of stuff, because we knew what was going on, you know. And it behooves other folks, man, not to look at people the way they want you to look at them, but look at them the way we should look at them, with some humanity, man, and some caring. And yeah.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you. Thank you. Mike, we definitely gonna circle back. Go ahead, V.
Yeah, no, I was gonna say that's why it's so important for us what we're talking about, and we're telling folks, like, you know, Maroon has stage 4 cancer, and it has to do with the diet and the environment. And being an elder, these things are even harder on his body right now, and that's why we want to bring in Gene Snyder, MD, who's a family physician that serves older adults in West Philadelphia right now. And we want her to talk to us more about the COVID and exactly what it is, so we can understand the seriousness that's happening right now with our elders, especially those that are incarcerated, our political prisoners, and, you know, the things that happens with the body. So, Gene, if you could talk to us a little bit about that. And thank you, you know, for making the time to come and speak with us on a serious issue.
I'm honored to be here with y'all, and COVID's really been tearing through the prisons in a pretty serious way, and it's so difficult to social distance effectively in the prisons. And we see that the risks are much more in older adults. So while some studies have shown that the case fatality rates are about 2% in general, that goes up to about 8% among people who are over 70. So there's a much more serious risk for these older adults who are in these conditions where they just can't physically distance from each other effectively. And, you know, putting everybody in a gymnasium where there is not adequate sanitation and support and the things that they need to treat their existing conditions, the things that they need as far as support for the existing conditions that he was dealing with is not humane. It's not medically appropriate, that he really should have access to what he needs for a safe and sanitary situation. And he should have access to his treatment and have treatment that's guided by his oncologists. That's really the optimal care and is not unduly interrupted. They've found ways for people to be able to get their treatment even during COVID, that they're being cautious about that on the outside, but there are ways that if people need to continue their treatment, they're able to do that. Some of the things that COVID can do to the body, primarily there's the respiratory illness, but it does cause other systemic effects. So the respiratory illness is going to be pneumonia and respiratory failure in some cases, but it also has effects on the heart. It can cause inflammation in the heart, heart rhythm problems. It also has a systemic effect that is favors the formation of blood clots, including blood clots in the legs that can travel to the lungs, something called pulmonary emboli, which is a pretty serious situation. And the risk for that is higher in people who have cancer. It's already like a procoagulant state. So those are some of the concerns that come up with COVID. And, you know, I'm not Maroon's doctor and not his oncologist, and it's important that he has continuous effective access to that team. And even after COVID, at 2 to 3 weeks, even for those people who aren't hospitalized, about a third of them, a little more than a third of them, still have some persistent symptoms. And so even though so there are things that we are coming to understand that there are there is more potential for long-term sequelae even after making it through the acute illness. And that certainly doesn't affect everybody, but it does affect a substantial number of people. Some of the things that they're doing, some of the things that they are doing for other congregate living settings, so situations where people are living together, need to be in close contact with each other, can't necessarily social distance effectively, like nursing homes, and where there are vulnerable older adults. The Center for Medicare Services actually requires testing of all staff and people in those settings, particularly, and the frequency that they recommend is that if your county prevalence, or the county test positivity, so the number, the percentage of tests that are coming back positive as a county, if that's more than 10%, that staff members should be tested twice weekly. And that doesn't sound like it's a thing that's been happening in the prisons, but people who are more deeply involved can, you know, tell me more about what's actually been going on there. And then I think that compassionate release is seriously underused and would be very appropriate for many of these older adults who have medical conditions.
So again, because I want people to understand and for us to highlight, you know, some of the challenges that those who are suffering from COVID-19 and these other illnesses, diseases that they are being passed and given through food, because we know for a fact, no one has left out and came into the community and contracted COVID-19 and then came back in. So that means that, you know, it's the staffs, the people, the workers that are bringing it in, and now you're contracting it. But what are the specific challenges that you may face, especially when you're part of the vulnerable population as an elder, such as Maroon? What are some of the challenges that he is facing now? And, you know, you talked a little bit about the respiratory, but what are some of the other things between the COVID-19 and having cancer as well? And, you know, yeah, his body being impacted because of the food. So,
yeah, I mean, there's the blood clot risk. Anemia is very common in colon cancer as well. And a diet that's low in iron doesn't help with that. With colorectal cancer specifically, there are some associations that a high fiber diet, so all of those good vegetables that you brought out to him, as well as whole grains and nuts seem to be associated with better outcomes. And then processed meats and cured meats seem to be particularly strongly associated with worse outcomes in terms of dietary factors. And of course, anyone drinking benzene is going to be very bad for them. And, you know, the things that are specifically carcinogens are really problematic.
So I want to thank you for that. And we don't want you to go anywhere because we want to, you know, talk with you a little bit more later on about, you know, just pushing forward and some of the things that we can do when it comes to helping with the health issues and then pushing to bring him home. Because in your personal opinion, would you say that it would be best for him to be released right now so we can take care of him and give him the care that he needs?
Yeah, I mean, given that he has a loving, supportive, like, home to come to, that I have faith in your ability to make sure he has great continuity of care and gets connected with the best specialists when he comes out, I think that would be great. I think that is so necessary. And truly, I think one of the things that's just, like, fundamental to caring for older adults is that at this point in life, you do have, like, certain rights to self-determination about your body, and it's not appropriate to be like forced into a particular course of treatment. That the decision making should be shared decision making, so that you really have all the options before you, and that you've got good support and that you have a choice about where and with whom you want to spend this portion of your life.
Thank you. Okay, so next I want to bring in our brother Salim, but before we do, I want to read something to you that the UN said in a response to the COVID crisis. They said, the UN human rights experts urged the United States government to reduce the population in places of detention to prevent large outbreaks of COVID-19 and ease the mounting pressure on staff and the penitentiary system as a whole. We call on the United States government to act now. Failure to take timely action may have far-reaching consequences, they said. People in detention throughout the U.S. are particularly vulnerable to COVID-19, and for many, their pre-existing medical conditions increase the risk of death, okay? That's what the experts noted. In these closed and often overcrowded places, basic protective measures such as physical distancing and hygiene rules cannot be observed. Those at greatest risk should immediately be identified, taken into account situations of vulnerability, and release measures should be implemented. Despite some steps at the federal and state levels to reduce the population of people in custody, the government's response has been insufficient. Minorities, including African Americans, are disproportionately represented, both among the prison population and among those succumbing to COVID-19. Thus, any failure to effectively mitigate the resultant risk is also an issue of racial discrimination and racial justice of paramount importance. So this was what they said, and they also, this was just a short version, they also said release political prisoners first. Those links will be at the bottom as well, so you can see as we go through and share you some things. And as you see on the screen, this is what's said. It's not our statements. The UN has said this, and they said release political prisoners, release the vulnerable population. And that's what we're talking about right now, why it needs to happen. So I want to go to our brother Salim Holbrook, and we want to bring him in, and we want to talk about, you know, how we could possibly make this happen going through bills. But we know it's going to take all of us working hard and putting this information out here. And Brother Salim Holbrook is the executive director of the Abolitionist Law Center. So he's going to talk to us a little bit about some of the bills that, you know, the governor has talked about, has acted and not acted on. So,
Thank you, Brother Salim. Hey, Sister V. What we do know is that that warning has gone unheeded by not only the United States, because our political prisoners continue to be in prison, but also by Pennsylvania. Since October 15th, 30 prisoners have died in the state's Department of Corrections from COVID. To give you a context, prior to that, that is more than double the amount that died since March when COVID hit the prison system. So it shows that we're in an epidemic, and the response by the state has been one of just utter failure, complete disregard for human life, a complete disinterest in human life and the pleas of family members of people that have loved ones in prison. Governor Wolf has the power to release people. He has the power of reprieve, which allows him to temporarily release people from terms of incarceration. He's not using it. He was given a list of over 1,600 prisoners that could be eligible for release back in June, and he released less than 200 of them. What's really unfortunate about that list is that list was not based on vulnerable populations. That list was not based on who needs to be released, because if that was the case, people like our elder Russell Maroon Schultz would be at the top of that release, someone who is 77 years old, battling stage 4 cancer, and just recently contracted COVID and has been in prison for over 50 years. He should be at the top of any reprieve lease, along with Mumia Abu-Jamal and hundreds and thousands of other prisoners who constitute a vulnerable population within the Department of Correction. That is people who are over the age of 65 and people who have autoimmune disorders. But this population is not being eligible for release because the Victims Advocate Office, the Pennsylvania District Attorney's Association, and what I would like to call the Lobby for Mass Incarceration, which is now a death lobby, is keeping people in prison and blocking not just reprieve, but they're blocking legislative bills that could bring this population home. New Jersey released over 2,000 people less than 2 weeks ago who were vulnerable. And they did it not only for people who were vulnerable, but they did it to create space in the prison, because look, you can't social distance in prison. It's impossible to social distance in prison. So prisons are essentially just one big incubator. I don't want to use the term death trap, but they potentially are. So the governor has this power of reprieve, but he has not exercised it. And that is something that we are demanding, and we are going to be demanding that in the media. We're going to be demanding that through direct action, and we're going to be demanding that through whatever means that we have. One of the things that families of prisoners did and advocates across the state was set a set of demands to not only Governor Wolf, but also the state legislature and the Department of Corrections These demands can be found at decarceratepa/COVID demands, and it could also be found on several social media pages like Human Rights Coalition, Abolitionist Law Center, Let's Get Free, Amnesty Law Project. But these demands are asking Governor Wolf to release people from prison in order to save lives, use his executive power. Listen, he has the power to wake up tomorrow morning and reprieve anyone he wants in the Department of Corrections. I'm going to repeat that. He doesn't have to get anyone else's approval. He can wake up tomorrow morning and issue reprieve. These are temporarily releases, right? But we want people to be home. So we'll deal with the temporary nature of the reprieve. Exercise your authority. That's what we are demanding, because he can't use the excuse, I can't do it. You can't use that excuse now. You have the absolute authority. We're asking him to sign all commutations and expedite commutation hearings. They're asking him to expand, expedite compassionate release. It is inconscionable that in order for Russell Maroon Schultz to be eligible for compassionate release, he has to get a death diagnosis. He has to have a doctor diagnose him and saying he's going to die within a certain amount of months. That is the only way he could even be eligible. I'm going to repeat that. Not be released for compassionate release, but just to be eligible for compassionate release, he has to have a death letter. That is unacceptable. We're asking for that to be changed. We are asking for access to essential services, health care, mental health treatment for the population, and to pursue any other measures, including medical furlough, to release as many elderly people as possible. We're also asking for him to mandate that prison guards, prison staff wear the N95 surgical mask as part of their uniform, that when they come in, they must wear this, because guards right now are wearing Make America Great masks. They're wearing just flimsy coverings over their faces, doing nothing. They should have those masks, as essential workers have those masks within the Department of Corrections. We're asking the PA legislature to afford parole eligibility to all elderly prisoners, to enact widespread sentencing reduction, and we're asking the DOC that during the time of an epidemic, they should expedite parole recommendations, and that there should be transparency. And most importantly, because I'm going to close with this again, I'm going to ask people to search for those demands on decarceratepa.info/COVID demands, as well as social media platforms like the Abolitionist Law Center, Human Rights Coalition, Let's Get Free, Amnesty Law Project. But we are also asking to, in addition to Russell Maroon Schultz's immediate release, we are also asking that the state include prisons in their daily updates about COVID in Pennsylvania. When they do that every morning, when the doctor comes out and says, this is what's happening in the state, we want people in prison, we want that to be reported. What's going on in prisons, the rates, the amount of people who are quarantined, the amount of people who have died, the amount of people who are infected, and more importantly, we don't want them referred to as inmates. We want them referred to as residents within correctional facilities. So thank you for giving me that space. I hope I didn't take up too much time. But again, please go to those demands. Lift them demands up on your platform.
We're out of time. I'd like to thank all of the speakers featured in today's show, as well as the Schultz family, for allowing us to share this audio with you. I would like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, Romero Funes, our assistant producer, and today's audio engineer. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Remember to visit our website, sotrueradio.org, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Our handle at @sotrueradio. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott, and y'all, please stay safe. We'll be right back.
listener-supported community radio.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meetings